Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
I'd like to continue the conversation that we started yesterday, in particular drawing on some elements of what Father James and Father Anselm were presenting concerning the way in which we apprehend meaning and the way in which we consider the meaning of artificial intelligence and what it has to say about our place in the world. There are four questions that I want to look at. The first is whether naming the world is simply an act of power, and whether our naming of the meaning of computers is simply a projection of meaning onto the computer. And I want to take a look at an account of the world that will make sense of the way that statistical AI techniques, such as neural networks, work. And then look at the moral dimension of meaning, this involvement of will in our assignment of meaning to names and to our devices, such as computers. And lastly, a consideration of a kind of spirituality of using AI so that it becomes for us a pointer to the world rather than a replacement for the world. I'll begin. Yesterday, I tried to show how early Christian theology led to accounts of the person and of human understanding, or intelligentsia, that AI doesn't really have room for. And today, I want to ask more deeply what artificial intelligence may be in itself, and how it fits into our own acts of intelligentsia. To do that, let us revisit why early AI techniques failed. Recall that the brittle symbolic AI of the 1950s through the 1980s worked with predefined sets of discrete categories that AI systems would relate to one another by strict logical relations. It was difficult to apply such AI techniques with strict propositional logic beyond constrained situations, because it was hard to figure out which category the object that was being seen through a camera could fit into. And it was also hard to detect these categories in the real world, and also hard to relate them to one another, because our common sense for moving through the world of physical, cultural, and social objects, our common sense for interacting with one another and with the things we encounter in the world, could not be enumerated by even tens of thousands of explicit rules. And in fact, there is a company, I think it's in Texas now, and I don't remember what the current name is, but the original project back in the 1980s was this project of trying to develop a database of rules that would explicitly represent our sensibility for moving through the world and interacting with one another. And they continue to hire researchers to explicitly represent in propositional logic, in formal logic, the relationships between everyday objects, such as coffee cups and what goes in them, and coffee cups shouldn't be turned upside down because the coffee might spill, and they're heavy, and you have to hold it. You could have thousands of rules just for coffee cups. But this was the great problem of symbolic AI. It was hard to figure out that you were looking at a coffee cup for the robot, and it was hard to know what to do with the coffee cup, even if you'd assigned it to its appropriate category. So much even more difficult for animals and human beings. So symbolic techniques falter wherever discrete categories are difficult to detect, unknown, or too subtly intertwined. Especially hard are those tasks in which humans attain to refined and effective sensibilities, in which we develop a kind of intuitive way of interacting with something, such as playing a violin or knowing when to make the right joke in a social situation. We excel at naming things, and we excel at imposing our will on the world, but when we try to define objectively what we have named, it seems to slip away. The problems cited here, along with immense advances in computing power, as I described yesterday, have brought recent eminence and superiority to non-symbolic or statistical AI, the neural networks that I described last time. Such computer programs do not hunt for propositionally defined objects in the data, but they adapt themselves statistically to a shifting pattern of input. AI works best when it does not deal with the world as a collection of discrete human-named objects that can be defined and detected by logical procedures representing propositional definitions. So in my talk today, I want to ask a few intertwined questions. Why is the world so hard to label when it seems so easy to grasp? We do it rather easily, but when we try to define the limits of our categories, they slip away, and the world seems to be seen better by the computer as a statistical blur rather than as a collection of well-defined objects. So secondly, then, what are these neural networks doing? Along the lines of what Father Ramelow pointed out yesterday concerning meaning, the theologian David Bentley Hart calls the operations of a computer merely physical events, devoid of meaning. Computers are not minds. They are not even models. Like printed books, they are systems of signs that exist as signs only at the whim of the beholder. It is because we treat a book as a book. It was because we treat a printed letter as representing a certain sound or a letter in our alphabet that it has that meaning. Otherwise, it would just be a kind of smudge on a page. So computers, too, have meanings, David Bentley Hart concludes, only so long as they are objects of the representing mind's attention. We compute, he claims. The computer does not. So if we want to be cynical about it, it seems we have a double doubt about the world and our engagement with it. First, discrete categories fail. When we label the world, then, is it possible that we are not identifying essences that are out there, but only imposing our wills on an undefinable sea of matter and energy? Are categories only convenient impositions? Second, the computer program that seems to best lay hold of whatever depth does underlie our judgments are themselves contingent mappings without any intrinsic significance of their own. So then, perhaps postmodernism is right, and all naming or classification is just an act of power. That our brains cut reality for survival, and our technical artifacts cut it for profit. In reply to this, I offer 2 points. First, my favorite 5th century theologian, Augustine of Hippo, gives an account of the created world that can make sense of the failures and the successes of different AI methods by explaining the world as God's self-expression, but as a kaleidoscopic refraction of divine wisdom, rather than a collection of discrete objects standing in simple relations to one another. Second, and more briefly, these ontological considerations can be united to Augustine's account of interpretive judgment as a moral act that is bound up with love. In order to say more about statistical AI and neural networks, in particular, I will argue that neural networks function as a kind of mapping between the world and human purposes. The human will is involved, and the human will is involved by giving meaning to the attunement between the machine, the computer, and human purposes in the world. And this is strikingly similar to what Augustine calls memory. As a mapping between human purposes and the world, the programmed computer may draw us to reduce reality to what we can measure of our purposes in the world, or better, it can be a pointer to reality. It may perhaps serve our own encounter with the created echoes of divine wisdom to discover more of the world and its manifestation of God. So, point 2, an account of the world that makes sense of how statistical AI works. Oh, well, we just did this. There you go. And just a note about the point that Father Anselm made yesterday, that that computers don't have any intrinsic meaning, and what David Bentley Hart says as well. Like, look, we have this, we have, here's our friend, the neural network from yesterday. It has all these things, input data, and there's a picture there, and then there are all these different steps it moves through, and then we have these labeled outputs, that it, things it has detected in the input picture, the face, the toy dog, the scene with couches and stuff. And you can get these networks to describe things pretty well, but in the end, what's actually coming into it are numbers. Well, not even numbers, not even ones and zeros, but just voltage levels on sensors or computer chips. And so in a certain sense, it has an arbitrary meaning. We could assign any labels we want to that. But of course, it won't work very well if we assign whatever labels we want to the computer. We made the computer so that it will reliably accomplish the things we want it to accomplish. But it's important to note that it doesn't accomplish these things without us. Because what the computer does is it takes the configurations that correspond to our labels, and then it transforms them into further configurations. And the reliability of the mapping between our labels and the transformations that the computing device applies to those labeled electrical signals is what makes the computer work. It's why this computer seems to be doing what it does quite independently of me. So when David Bentley Hart says, we don't, or the computer doesn't compute, we compute, that seems kind of preposterous because I have no idea how the computer is doing what it's doing. I'm not computing, I'm using a computer. But on the other hand, what the computer is doing has been designed by human engineers. And the reason why I can just look at the screen and think, well, the computer did it, I had nothing to do with that, is because this technical device, this artifact, is designed so that these interior configurations of energy will be transformed into a form that I can read. But note well, what form has it transformed the configurations of energy into? These little bright dots. But these little bright dots are arranged according to the letters that we conventionally attribute meaning to in our culture. And so all the way down, the computing device is a device through which we compute. But it's not I or you. It's not even the engineers at can't tell what brand this is, but I assume it's a Dell. Usually Dells are found in corporate environments. So the Dell engineers and Intel and everybody involved in the pretty exciting project of designing a computer and making it work, it is actually, in a certain way, our society as a whole that is computing through the computer. Because no single person in this room, no single person in our society is solely responsible for the functional efficacy of this computer. But if you were to take this computer outside of human society, if human society were never to have existed, then all these little configurations would be meaningless. So in a certain way, the computer is drawing forth meaning from us, shared meaning in our society. By the way, just as books do, right? Shared meaning in our society in the way that we align meanings with these little signs. But at the same time, the computer also has to be attuned to the way the world works. Otherwise, the computer would say stuff that wasn't true. And so the efficacy of artificial intelligence is a combination. It's the meeting between our culturally imposed meanings on signs, and then the development through engineering and computer programming of a device that is attuned to the dynamics of what happens out there and then translates those dynamics into a kind of distilled form here that we can read. All right. So that's my pitch for why naming is not domination, but rather it's alignment between our wills and our goals and the way the world works. All right, now let's talk about the world. I propose that many problems that bedevil symbolic methods are solved handily by a neural network because, in a manner of speaking, the network is receptive to and imprinted by the dynamics of the world as the world is accessible to the network or presented to the network. We could say that it develops a point of view, not a conscious experience, not a subjective apprehension, but something like, as I said yesterday, the classical notion of the mind's conformity to the thing. Although here, the conformity between the neural network and the world is always constrained by our goals, by the task for which the network is trained. Why is this? Computer scientist and philosopher Brian Cantwell Smith argues that symbolic AI fails because the world does not actually come to us chopped up into neat, ontologically discrete objects that stand in unambiguous relations. When we apprehend the world conceptually, he claims, we are not simply reading it, but judging it. From this point of view, which has strong affinities with the Augustinian intelligentsia that I described yesterday, our conceptual hold on things is not false, but it is still deeply contingent and partial. Our concepts, what Augustine calls the verba mentis, can be thought of as engagements with the world, rather than simply as detached simulations of the things we encounter. Nonetheless, we are able to meaningfully engage in logical reasoning. We are able to meaningfully discuss the things we find out there in the world and the hold we have on them, because the concepts that flow from our judgments remain grounded, especially when we discuss them, by our sense for those objects' situatedness in the world. A situatedness that can't be replaced by any finite set of logical descriptions standing on their own. For Thomas Aquinas, this situatedness of things in the world is depicted in our minds by our hold on the so-called phantasm of a thing. The phantasm is not a particular image or a sign of the things that we have encountered, but a kind of imaginative grasp of a thing's way of being in the world. So last night I had an interesting discussion with Father Irenaeus about this, he was describing how he had described raccoons for a friend of his who was from Australia who had never seen a raccoon. And he said, well, you know, the raccoon's kind of, it's small. It looks a little bit like a bear with a pointy snout. It tends to wash its hands or lick its hands before it eats. And it always, you know, it shows up unexpectedly and it'll startle you when you're out by your trash cans. And I would add to my children, because I'm always cautioning them about the great dangers of the great outdoors, and they kind of roll their eyes at me. I hope to impart to them vigilance rather than pathology, but we'll see that there. Additionally, the raccoon does carry parasites that which no known medicine can eradicate. So beware of the droppings of raccoons. But otherwise, enjoy the raccoon. But it's not quite enough to just say you can recognize the raccoon because it washes its hands or because it has markings that make it look like it's wearing a little, you know, bank robber's mask from a comic book. That's enough to enable you to name the raccoon when you see it. Aha, that's the raccoon that I was told about. But really, to depict a raccoon to someone who's never seen a raccoon, you want to give them more than just criteria by which to recognize it. You want to give them a sense for the raccoon. They can't actually develop it. They can't accurately abstract the form of the raccoon, as Thomas would say, or judge the verba mentis that corresponds to the raccoon, as Augustine would say, unless they really kind of have an encounter with raccoonness. And that's why you have to evoke within someone else's mind the phantasm of the raccoon, not just a kind of sketch of the picture, but a sensibility for the raccoon's way of being. This is in part why human culture we tend to have recourse to poetry for precisely those things that are most important, but also hardest to define simply, because we have to draw someone else imaginatively, affectively, intellectually into the previously unknown reality that we're trying to depict for them. And you can see the difference between criteria of recognition and deep familiarity with the essence of something if you think about children who are pretending to be married. So little kids, they'll say, let's play house. You hunt, I cook. For them, marriage is all about keeping things clean and feeding the smaller people in the house, because that's all they see. And maybe, I don't know, maybe if they're trying to have a really gritty house playing together, they might pretend to fight and then hopefully pretend to make up and, you know, resolve their differences. But the fact of the matter is that six-year-olds actually don't really understand the whole atmosphere of marriage, because they don't have the psychological equipment. It's not just that they're incapable of reproduction. They're incapable of experiencing one another as men and women, because they haven't yet passed through adolescence. And that's why in adolescence, kids are all like weird. Like, the opposite sex is scary but fascinating, and because something very new, a very new awareness has opened to them, and it doesn't fit into "you hunt, I cook." That doesn't work anymore. And so that's the sense that, so when I'm speaking of phantasm, for Aquinas, the phantasm is, yes, a chiefly imaginative reality. And I'm happy to be corrected by the Thomists, who actually know what they're talking about on this. But what, Spanish makes this distinction also between saber, when you kind of know a fact, and conocer, when you have a kind of contact with it. Like, you can, the verb saber, knowing fact, can apply to your knowledge of when the library closes. Like, the library closes at 8 p.m. But if you've ever wanted to retrieve your laptop from the campus library and get a book for that you need for the exam or the paper that's due tomorrow, and you stand looking through the glass into the closed library, seeing your belonging on a table and your book but unable to reach them, that's when you've reached conocer, concerning what it means for the library to be closed. That's what I'm talking about with the failure of symbolic AI, that symbolic AI can classify library closure, but it doesn't capture, except by an infinite number of logical rules, like what it means, the kind of acquaintance with the reality of the closed library or of the raccoon. All right, nonetheless, we are able to engage in logical reasoning because our concepts flowing from our judgments remain grounded by our sense for their situatedness in the world. Symbolic AI fails then, perhaps because it attempts to leap from sensation to abstraction, from sensation to the classification of a thing. That is, from sense data to the categories of Aristotelian forms, or in Augustinian language, from sensation to the verbum mentis that captures a thing, but without having gathered by experience an attunement to the phantasm of a thing, to its way of being in the world. Statistical machine learning methods, I will argue, do capture something of the phantasm, something of a thing's way of being in the world, its way of manifesting the meaning of what it is in relation to and by interaction with other things. By capturing a thing's situatedness, which is always more than a category name and a set of distinctions by which to separate it from other things, by capturing a thing's situatedness, statistical methods have racked up the astonishing successes that they have in image recognition, speech processing, and even the confabulation of news articles, poetry, fiction, and art. Augustine describes a world amenable to this situation. For Augustine, creation's deep coherence rests on the rationes, reasons, or principles of the world that are not reducible to verbal definitions, but that are engaged conceptually by our judgments. For Augustine, God is the source of the rationes. His single and simple life is truth and wisdom. And he has created all these things in light of what Augustine calls his own eternal reasons, aspects of divine wisdom that are undifferentiated in God, but are distinguished as simply multiple and uniformly multiform through the prism of his creative acts by which he creates the expressions here below. Like the spectrum of colors, continuous in itself but differentiated by our labeling, God's simple wisdom is contingently divided by being expressed through the panoply of creatures. There is, for Augustine, no necessarily fixed number of species, but infinite potential varieties. So you can see there are two medieval icons here. This is actually from the time period in which Thomas Aquinas himself is active. Somewhere between 1250 and 1272 is when this illumination was made. And this one is somewhere in the early 12th century, 1100, 1120 maybe. And you get these aspects of the Augustinian, which Thomas has his own version of it too, especially expressed in the Summa Contra Gentiles, this notion of creation as a refraction of the divine wisdom. Because here you have, across the top, it says, in principio, creavit Deus, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And you see Christ here, who is strongly associated with the divine wisdom, and the prototypes of all things. And the geometer's arc here, the compass that he's using, it almost seems to be like a medical device opening his abdomen here, like a womb, and contained within the womb of the Logos, contained within the womb of the second person of the Trinity, is the surging light and darkness from the very beginning of creation that is being now measured and set in order by his action. So what we have here is a visual depiction of that, the second person of the Trinity. Who is he in himself? He's the second person of the Trinity. He's a someone. He's the eternally begotten Son. But when he expresses himself by the initial act of expression by which God expresses himself to the world is the act of creating the world. And so in a certain sense, when we look at the divisions of creatures, when we look at the spectrum of created natures, what we are looking at is an outward expression of the kind of infinitely multipliable meaning of the single second person of the Trinity. So he's making something outwardly, but the outward making of the world is also a showing forth of the interior goodness and the interior wisdom of God, which is always a personal goodness and a personal wisdom because God is a personal God. Then we have a different version of that here on the right-hand side, where instead of seeing Christ as kind of opening himself to bring forth creation, and this idea of like creation coming forth from the womb of the Logos should not be mistaken as a metaphysical statement. It's not the case that creation is like some stuff from inside God that is brought forth. Augustine and Thomas both have a strong sense of creation from nothing, that God causes to exist what formerly did not exist. But Augustine says it's also like when we speak. We cause a vibration in the air that was not formerly there, but the vibration in the air is an outward communication of what is already within us. And so creation is both distinct from God and is in a certain way a sending forth of God's expressive goodness. On the right-hand side, you have a different version of creation. And this one is a little more, it's a little more clunky because it has all these little circles to show the different stages of creation. But whereas on the left-hand side, you have creation as coming forth as an expression from within the Logos, on the right-hand side, you have Christ again. And the passage on the book that he's holding says, I, the Lord... I am the Lord making all these things. And so what we have here is a depiction of all the distinct elements, the historical contingency of the 7 days of creation. God could have done it in many ways. He chose to do it that way, or at least he chose to tell us about it in that way. But all of this is gathered around and converges on the second person of the Trinity, converges on the Logos. And so there's a sense of the spirituality of dealing with creation, that when we apprehend the individuated things of the world, they can for us be reconciled as if we, by our spiritual life, are regathering these created things into their home in God. This is what Augustine calls referring our love of created things to God, or enjoying the created thing in God. Loving it in God is a way of reconciling the many things God has made to the single simplicity of God himself. All right. So creation's deep coherence rests on the rationes, reasons or principles that cannot simply be reduced to verbal definitions, but are engaged conceptually by our judgments. And God is the source of these rationes. His single simple life is truth and wisdom, and he's created all things in light of this wisdom, undifferentiated in himself, but distinguished outwardly as simply multiple and uniformly multiform through the prism of his creative action. Divine wisdom is thus expressed doubly in the kinds of things created according to the rationes, and here we have a kind of image of that, and divine wisdom is also expressed in God's providential governance of the whole, by which the ways of these things are expressed in their interactions with one another. The greatest obstacle to a kind of theological medieval appreciation of creation is the kind of 18th century sensibility about of things as specimens, which reaches its high point in the kind of the 1950s, where, you know, a museum, like, everything's white, and then there's a single thing suspended, kind of deracinated, decontextualized, suspended as a specimen, almost like in a laboratory. They even got into this in the 50s for cocktails too, where they just have vodka with a single espresso bean at the bottom of it. You know, this kind of specimen approach to things, which is beautiful. You can deeply appreciate things when they're taken out of their natural context and you're confronted with the particularity of something. But in the end, it is not that squirrels are different from trees. That's not enough to tell us what a squirrel is. We also have to see the squirrel scuttling up the tree in order to really grasp something of squirrelness. And it's not enough to say that squirrels aren't rabbits. Rabbits are ground-dwelling and squirrels are tree-dwelling. We have to eventually see the whole forest to get a deep appreciation for the essence of this particular animal. So this is why divine wisdom is expressed doubly in the kinds of things created, squirrels versus rabbits, but also in God's providential governance of the whole. God brings forth forests in which squirrels and rabbits both live, and their joint participation in this ecosystem draws forth from the squirrel and the rabbit the different ways of acting. We see this with human beings. What is it to be a man? Well, you can watch, you know, men doing various things, but it's also useful to watch, like, a man walking a dog, and then you see a little bit more of what it means to be a human being. Or a man interacting with a woman, and you catch a little bit more of the particularities of male and female. So through providential governance, God elicits the expression of the rationes from various kinds. As for kinds, the nature and capacities that are displayed in the life of each created thing reflect, facets-like, the goodness and wisdom of God. Augustine writes, "Through wisdom all things were made. And the changes that we now see in creatures, measured by the lapse of time as each one fulfills its proper function, comes to creatures from the causal rationes implanted in them, which God scattered as seeds at the moment of creation. When he spoke and they were made, he commanded and they were created. Thus, in the contingency of history itself, God's providential governance elicits creatures' interacting harmonies by the unfolding of temporal events." It's very interesting that Augustine describes it this way, because at least the kind of cartoon stereotype of a kind of Platonistic approach to the world, and Augustine does inherit strand of the Platonic tradition, is that, you know, Platonism is all about, like, you see the shadows here below, but you're looking for the forms above. You want to escape from flux, escape from corporeality, escape from time, to come to rest in eternity beyond bodies, beyond images. And the Christian tradition has some of that too. The scriptures themselves, in the book of Revelation, the letters of Paul speak to this kind of ascent beyond contingency into the finality of God himself. But the mode of our ascent is not by ignoring time. The mode of our ascent is by receiving God's self-revelation, which for Christianity and Judaism is a self-revelation that happens in time. The point I'm trying to make is that because God is an active and creative and providential God, the unfolding of events within time is a further accumulation of the self-manifestation of God and a further accumulation of the self-manifestation of creatures, even though God himself is unchanging. But we receive him through our formation, journeying through time. How might we apply this notion of the rationes and of time to the world as seen by a neural network? The nature of the attunement between neural networks and the world is difficult to explore, because as physicist and computer scientist Judea Pearl writes, neural networks are opaque. You'll see from time to time news articles where it'll say, like, OpenAI CEO admits, we don't know how this works. Even when tuned to their training data and able to generalize to new data, the interior sensitivities of the neural network are not easily interpreted. If you look at the interior layers of the network and try to figure out what they're activated by, sometimes it seems to make no sense. It does not follow a kind of hierarchy of features. Like, if a facial recognition network does not develop dedicated areas for recognizing eye color and dedicated areas for recognizing the size of someone's lips, which are the kinds of things which we might expect. That's what we think we're doing. But neural networks are far more developing the kind of sensitivity that we have when we catch sight of something from the corner of our eye. It's kind of the total presentation of something that somehow is worked out through these layers to form a sense of the phantasm, right? A sense of the way of being that the object has in the world. Even when tuned to their training data and able to generalize to new data, the interior sensitivities of the network are not easily interpreted. Eminent computer scientist Peter Norvig argues that their statistical attunement, quote, describes what does happen, but making no claim to correspond to the generative process used by nature, the network does not answer the question of why something happens. So neural networks have been particularly useful for predicting the courses of hurricanes, because these are statistically accessible and predictable natural phenomena. But you can't go into the network to get a theory of the weather, at least not one that we could explicitly describe. So Norvig says they describe what does happen, but they don't correspond to nature's generative processes, and so they don't describe why it happens. I would argue that Norvig's statement is of ambiguous value. It is true, networks do not develop propositional theoretical models, nor do they even develop theoretical models that seem to correspond to the mathematics of known physics. But if Brian Smith is right, then the network may say quite a bit, even if it does so obscurely. If Thomas is right about the phantasm, and if Augustine is right that nature's behavior gives voice to the rationes, then how could AI's powers of recognition not somehow arise from correspondence with the deep flow of nature's generative processes, especially if these rationes give our theoretical concepts their success as engagements with nature itself? So, let us dig deeper than Norvig would allow. Consider a hypothetical but technologically realistic example of a neural network trained to distinguish grasses, wildflowers, and trees with fidelity to distinct scientific categories. So again, you can download these apps on your phone. There's an app called Seek where you can point your phone at some natural object, a plant or insect, and it will identify it for you. These are all using neural networks. In the earlier layers of the network, we might observe activity that is quite out of keeping with our own scientific hierarchical classifications. For instance, certain areas of the network might be equally highly activated by the subtle ridging on a blade of grass, the stalk of a valerian wildflower, and the needles of certain conifers, even though these plants belong to vastly separated genetic lineages. Were this but a matter of surface-level similarity, with no more conceptual heft than the redness of a coral snake being grouped with that of a red panda, then we might agree that the network's activity reveals less about nature's integrity than about features that conveniently accord with our own purposes. But in our hypothetical plant-recognizing network, the visual similarities of grass, stalk, and needle are not mere surface coincidence. A ridged configuration strengthens these plants' narrow structures, which are mostly hollow but must remain stiff to perform their function. In grouping these three, then, the wildflower, the blade of grass, and the pine needle, the neural network is attuned to what we know to be a manifested harmonization of gravity, force of wind, capillary action, and in the movement of fluid through the plant, a hint of metabolism. These three plants are not at all closely related, nor do they share a common environment, but they do share a common world. And as expressions of this kingdom of life, they have settled into a groove that expresses something not only about these particular organisms, or even about their local environment, but also about the natural harmony of Earth as a whole, something of wisdom's rationes indeed. You can think also about musical instruments. Like, we classify musical instruments by the way that they function. But within those classifications, the way that they function, like the woodwinds or the brass, they have common shapes, and they have common shapes because there's a common physics to the way you make vibrations in the air. It always annoyed me when I was a kid that pianos were classified as percussion instruments, because I thought, no, percussion instruments sound like this, or boom, boom, boom. They don't sound like a piano, but if the piano's percussion because the hammers strike the strings. But there is something weird about the piano, too, because most percussion instruments are causing sound by echoing within a chamber, like striking the head of a drum or hitting a mallet or something. But the piano has the vibration not on the surface of the vibrating chamber, but it is a string vibrating within the chamber of the wooden piano. So that's why it sounds so different. It's percussion because of the way we elicit the sound, but it does kind of belong in its own class because of the way that the sound is made. So all of these things a neural network can capture. So it points to certain features of the environment that don't fit into very easy scientific classifications, but actually bear witness to the deep harmony of the natural world. So the neural network at its best is attuned not to happy accidents, but to the rationes. The network's mathematics do not refute so much as deepen our notion of concepts, not as replicas, but as engagements with those rationes. The network is not a model or a simulator. The network is a mapping between our purposes and the way the world works. The network's output categories, yes, are determined by human designers. Therefore, the network must accomplish a mapping from the rationes to our interests. It will work insofar as our interests do preserve the rationes. And I'll say more about that on the last day. Much as our own categories will work only so long as they uphold the features of our experience. What does it mean to preserve the rationes, or for our concepts to engage these rationes, even as these concepts are begotten by an act of will that could even distort our reality? Recall David Bentley Hart's claim: the computer is a system of signs that exists by our treating it as such a system. This position is true so far as it goes, but it does not make computation meaningless or arbitrary. As with printed text, we assign both functions and semantic content, meanings, to our tools and computers based on culturally shared frames, ways of treating or interpreting the things that we've made. These are intentional frames, and here intentionality refers not to voluntariness, but to the aboutness of our thoughts. These framings determine the design and our interpretation of, for instance, a screwdriver's handle, a computer's output images, and the printed characters on a page. And there are reasons why we treat certain things certain ways. And we look at something and we say, that's a weird-looking screwdriver. It's a weird-looking screwdriver not just because it looks different from other screwdrivers, but often because it's not going to work as well, because it's not as well attuned to the movement of our hand and the way we use a screwdriver. But nonetheless, it's a screwdriver because we call it a screwdriver, because we use it as such. So you can use your fingernail as a screwdriver if you want. That's what makes it a screwdriver in that moment, although it might be a better or worse screwdriver. Okay, so we assign functions and semantic content to our tools and computers based on culturally shared frames, ways of treating or interpreting the things we've made. As these framings determine the design. Oh yeah, I said this already. Okay, so as observer-dependent realities, our artifacts are contingent, but they are not arbitrary. But to understand them rightly, we must recognize that they're mappings between the world and our purposes. Now, the fact of intentional framing indicates the ground upon which we may consider AI theologically. Observer-attributed meanings, the way that we label the output values of the neural network, are tied up with the device's service to our purposes. An AI system mediates between our goals and the world with which it is engaged. Yet, from an Augustinian perspective, this does not reduce concepts or computers to arbitrary exercises of power. To understand what we are doing when we design and use our technological devices, we can look again to Augustine's notion of understanding itself. Every act of understanding involves an act of will. And for Augustine, our acts of interpreting natural things, signs, and artifacts all follow the same fundamental sequence. We apprehend something, we judge it as good, we cling to it with our love, and now we have an understanding of the thing as it is presented to us and the thing as we are oriented toward treating it. This verbum mentis is a particular embrace by the mind of some facet of reality. For Augustine, in the words of theologian Luigi Gioia, intellectual knowledge is not the result of an infusion in our mind of a pre-existing reality. It is rather the production of a new reality. This verbum mentis is truer as it approaches an embrace of the ratio as that ratio is. So the truest verbum mentis is the one that is most aligned with the ratio of the thing. And every act of understanding is a moral judgment, and habitual moral judgments of this sort form our habit of seeing the world. If someone is used to, if somebody goes to elementary school and they're looking to become the most popular person in the school, then they slowly become habituated, slowly acculturated to treating people as opportunities for the advancement of prestige. Augustine calls the ground of this habitual way of seeing the world our memory, our memoria. While corporeal things cannot be kept always before our physical eyes, memoria makes present the objects that we desire or think about. But the memoria is not a movie screen or data repository or filing cabinet of images. Rather, it's an implicit knowledge of objects and experiences, a fabric of varyingly accurate rationes built up from our apprehension in the verbum mentis. The more we judge the world, the more those judgments, those senses of the meanings of the phantasms or the verbum mentis that is the kind of concept of the thing we've judged, those build up into this fabric of memoria, which itself becomes, for Augustine, the kind of the deep grammar from which we draw forth new judgment. So our habit of judging the world and our habit of judging other things shapes our expectation for what the world is, and that expectation or memoria becomes the foundation of new judgments. The way we see the world makes us continue to see the world in that way, and that both for good and for ill. Desire or love, the will's implicit judgment concerning the thing known, draws the object anew into explicit thought as a verbum mentis from the memoria. So, and this is actually neuroscience that's shown at least the physiological side of this, that every time we remember something, we are reconstructing the memory, which is a bit of a scary thought. But the reconstruction is usually fairly stable. We don't change that easily. But this is also how one can deal with traumatic memories as well. Every time we remember, we also interpret. And when we reinterpret the things that we recall, their significance changes. And because the significance of everything that we know is its significance also with respect to me, then the remembered, say, horrific experience of being victimized by another person, when we reinterpret it, that's not a matter of denying what actually happened. That's a matter of giving a different significance to myself and to what happened to me now in the present, other than the significance it had in the past. And Augustine would say this is a kind of reworking of our memoria by fresh judgment, so that the verba mentis of that thing, that event or of that person or of that thing can be reshaped to a manner that is truer with respect to the world, myself, and what this ultimately means in light of God. So more than permitting implicit presence, the memoria is a kind of ground for thought, and it is formed by thought. One's past apprehensions become the fibers from which one's present intuitive leaps are made, and concepts past and present are rewoven. It is the deep substructure of understanding wherein the verba mentis of past and future subsist. The memoria is like a cognitive palette cultivated by the things one tastes attentively, and it shapes what and how one is able to taste, as past judgments shape the present. Let us return now to the question of the neural network. As an artifact, the programmed computer receives its semantics, it receives its meaning from the meaning-making framing, the intentional frame that is constituted by the judgments of those who share that frame and use that device. Now, the trained neural network maps the rationes of some data set or something in the world to categories that are of interest to the system's designer and to our moral and conceptual engagement with reality. We classify, we label the things that we want to pay attention to, and we pay attention to them for some further purpose. So there's always a kind of begetting of a verba mentis involved in our use of any technological device or system. As with the network sensitive to ridged stalks, the memoria of the neural network is, the memoria, our memoria, is not transparently interpretable in terms of scientific classifications or always formal conceptual relationships. But also so too, neither is the neural network. And so we can consider the neural network as a kind of artifactual or artificial memoria, a memoria that has its meaning within our usage according to human interest and utility. Its meaning as used in the world involves both the intentions and ideas and concepts and judgments that shape the system's architecture and the concepts and judgments of the person who uses the system. When the AI, therefore, is read or taken as a prompt of action or contemplated for what it reveals, it has its ultimate reference not to God, as the natural world does, but to us as the designers and users of the system. And so to conclude, what sort of spirituality might we assess for our use of AI? It is fitting to conclude by recalling Peter Norvig's suggestion that we might rightly be satisfied with statistical AI which describes what happens but doesn't answer the question of why. I suggest that such satisfaction would be dangerous because the opacity of the network's reasoning lends itself to becoming a replacement for rather than an invitation to the world, reducing our engagement with the world to the scope of the desires and intentions that can be successfully mapped within the neural network for our activity in the world. At this point, we would risk rewriting the world itself as a resource for the accomplishment of our designs with ourselves rather than divine wisdom as the world's ultimate meaning. I include there a fittingly, I'm pretty sure that's an AI-generated image, AI-generated image of Marduk, the Babylonian god, because the Babylonians were a fascinating culture. They had elaborate tables and methods and algorithms that they developed for predicting the positions of the stars. And they predicted the positions of the stars because of their need for these astrological predictions of what would happen in the empire. But unlike the Greeks, the Babylonians never asked why the formulae worked. And because they never asked why the formulae worked, in a way that's kind of fitting because of the Babylonian cosmology. The world is the bisected carcass of a chaos dragon. What you want in Babylonian culture is to be able to manage a hostile world. And so the algorithmic tables of the prediction of the positions of the stars are useful for predicting victories, health, harvests, storms, etc., the things you need to get by in what is finally a hostile and, underneath itself, meaningless world, held together by the superior force of the emperor and ultimately of the gods. But a Greek and finally a Christian understanding of the way we use AI would not have artificial intelligence be a buffer between us and an otherwise intractable world. But artificial intelligence is a way to get deeper into the world, which means we have to be very careful to recognize the limitations of what a particular AI is capable of, and not ascribe to it a comprehensive meaning that our own labelings and our own purposes do not have. All right, thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.